John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, June the 8th, 2011. The border between Gaza and Egypt at Rafah has been reopened, according to Gaza border official Ayoub Abu Sha'ar. The border had been closed by Hamas in protest at closures, delays and limits enforced by Egyptian authorities that were not discussed with Hamas. Dozens of Palestinians stormed the Egyptian terminal on Saturday after Egypt unexpectedly closed its side of the border. The border was reopened to foot passengers. However, Hamas complained that elderly and sick passengers still could not cross. The border will finally reopen under an agreement that allows for 400 pre-agreed individuals to cross each day. The UNRWA has released a report undermining recent media reports that the West Bank economy was booming under the PA and Israeli occupation, according to research author Salem Ajlouni. According to UNRWA's findings, the real unemployment rate in the West Bank stood at 25% in the second half of 2010, up from 23.5% in 2009. The rate of unemployment amongst refugees was up 1% to 27.9%. The Palestine News Network reports that on Wednesday afternoon, extremist settlers set fire to crops owned by Palestinian farmers near Hebron. It is alleged that the settlers came from the settlement of Kiryat Arba. The wheat crops and land they were planted on are owned by Palestinians from the village of Bani Naim. The crops were entirely destroyed. Local sources report that a number of Jewish settlers broke into the Al-Aqsa compound and began drinking wine and smashing bottles on the floor. Consumption of alcohol is forbidden in Islam, and such acts are considered desecration. The group allegedly broke through a gate near the Western Wall and were protected by Israeli police. Police only intervened to ensure that angry worshippers from the mosque were kept separate from the settlers. The Al-Aqsa Mosque and Dome of the Rock are considered the third holiest site in Islam. The act of desecration was allegedly a result of calls to celebrate the Shavuot holiday at the site. Tensions have been particularly high in East Jerusalem recently as a result of inflammatory marches on Jerusalem Day last week and Israeli MK Michael Ben-Ari's tour of the mosque with a group of settlers on Tuesday. That's all from today for the IMEMC. This was Wednesday the 8th of June's daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This report has been brought to you by Hossam Qassis and me, David Steele.
Iraq, Wednesday. Another American soldier was killed in Iraq while on a patrol. This may have been during a separately reported IED attack that set two U.S. military Humvees on fire near Jajaf. This comes just 2 days after five U.S. soldiers were killed in Baghdad when rockets hit their barracks and Camp Loyalty on Monday. Hilla, Iraq, Tuesday. An explosive charge detonated against a U.S. Army patrol in western Iraq's province of Babel on Tuesday, but losses were not reported, a Babel security source reported. He added that American forces, quote, began to shoot in the air, and eyewitnesses saw columns of smoke coming from the venue of the explosion. Wait a minute. What U.S. patrols? What roadside bombs? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh, yeah. That's been said before. Baghdad, Iraq, Wednesday. A roadside bomb hit a police patrol, wounding four people in central Baghdad's Karada district, an Interior Ministry source reported. This has been going on for the past 8 years. Khyber Agency, Pakistan, Wednesday. At least seven oil tankers supplying fuel to NATO forces in Afghanistan were destroyed in a bomb blast near Torkham border. Vehicles were parked at a parking lot near the border when a magnetically attached bomb planted at one of the tankers exploded in the afternoon. The blast caused a huge fire, burning down six other oil tankers parked in the area. Quote, the fire was so huge that it was impossible for us to control it on time, said one firefighter. Pakistan, Wednesday. Another U.S. drone strike in North Waziristan killed 23 people, mostly low-level Taliban fighters, according to Pakistani security officials. Mr. Barack Obama, nobody has ever been able to govern Afghanistan. You didn't kill Osama bin Laden with a drone strike, and the only thing U.S. troops are doing in Iraq is exposing themselves to attack. Now's the time to call it a day, pull the plug, and bring all the troops home before, instead of after, even one more ends up with life-ruining wounds or in yet another flag-draped casket. Two Iraqi men were arrested in Bowling Green, Kentucky back in May. They are being charged in a grand jury indictment in U.S. domestic courts with supporting insurgents in their home country in occupied Iraq and with conspiring to bomb U.S. troops in Iraq, a country in which many people are engaged in a state of active warfare against the United States. In other words, U.S. domestic courts are claiming battlefield jurisdiction over the Iraq War. These two men are not charged with attempting to bomb anything or anyone inside the U.S. They are charged with trying to do something in Iraq, where U.S. courts are not supposed to have jurisdiction. The two men, Awad Ramadan Alwan, age 30, and Mohammed Sharif Hamadi, age 23. Assistant Attorney General Todd Heenan said, quote, over the course of roughly 8 years, Awad Ramadan Alwan allegedly supported efforts to kill U.S. troops in Iraq, first by participating in the construction and placement of improvised explosive devices in Iraq, and more recently, by attempting to ship money and weapons from the United States to insurgents in Iraq. Similar charges have been filed against Hamadi. Supporting evidence against Alwan includes a fingerprint on a shell recovered in Iraq, which is not some place the FBI or U.S. courts are supposed to have jurisdiction, except for U.S. military courts over offenses committed by members of the U.S. military. Alwan was said to have been drawn into an FBI sting in which he boasted of attacking the U.S. Army in Iraq. In September 2010, Alwan was said to have shipped money and weapons to Sunni insurgents in Iraq. Hey, Department of Justice and President Obama, how is it that U.S. courts do not have the jurisdiction to judge men being held without trial in Guantanamo Bay, supposedly captured on the battlefield, but do have jurisdiction over someone else on the battlefield? These two Iraqis should be considered soldiers of their country every bit as much as the U.S. Navy SEALs who entered Pakistan on the mission to kill Osama bin Laden were soldiers of their country. They may even regard themselves as being on an anti-terrorism mission when you think about what the U.S. has done to Iraq. Therefore, the U.S. may, under the laws of war, either hold these men as declared prisoners of war and also grant prisoner of war status to all the men in Guantanamo Bay, or else grant trials in civilian court to every detainee in Guantanamo Bay, as well as to these two Iraqis. Many have argued that civilian trials for anyone captured on any battlefield will lead to court jurisdiction over every shell fired and every bomb dropped in every war. Many in the U.S., especially Republicans and members of the military, fear this scenario. Why then is it okay for Wad Ramadan Alwan and Mohanad Sharif Hamadi to face charges in U.S. court, but not okay for those suspected of war crimes in Iraq, such as those infamous Blackwater contractors, to face trial in the civil courts of Iraq?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com.
On the 27th of May, U.S. Park Police violently arrested several people for dancing inside the Jefferson Memorial. This week, on the 4th of June, an overwhelming number of dancing protesters retook the Jefferson Memorial. Police made no arrests, but instead pushed them out and blocked anyone else from approaching the memorial.
Last week, there was a group that came to protest the fact that a judge had decided that there's no dancing here. And I was arrested literally for swaying back and forth.
We're moving, man.
We're
in love.
We're touching each other. Sorry. We're stopping. What are you doing?
You're
not arresting us for standing
for
here.
For what? You didn't even give me a warning.
Others were body slammed and choked.
Sir, it's your last warning.
I got a broken shoulder.
Put your hands behind your back.
And so today we have a lot more people coming to say, we as Americans think we have the right to dance. Let the dancers dance in peace. Let's see what happens.
If they're arrested today and not eligible for release, they won't be released until Monday.
Why are people being arrested for silent
dancing? Ma'am, I don't make the laws. I function as our court liaison. I'm just help to, here
so
to help.
So if I go in there and just go like this by myself, will I be arrested?
I'm not making that determination. That is
who will make that determination?
The officials in charge of the scene.
Could you ask somebody? I'd like to know exactly what movements I'm allowed to do. See, one of the problems in this whole thing is they can't tell you what dancing is. You know, when I say, if I do this in the chamber, will I be arrested? She said, we're going to give you ample warning. I said, well, ample warning for what? That I have to stand still, that I can't move, I couldn't go like this, and, you know, they won't define it.
This is a cause that transcends partisanship or ideology of any kind, because this is about basic human dignity. So let's dance!
Dance, dance, revolution!
But no slam dancing.
This is what freedom looks like! This is what we look like!
Go, please move out this way. Thank you. For safety reasons, I need you to move. Thank you. Start moving.
The area is actually temporarily closed. We proceed out the columns. Thank you.
We can dance. We can dance. We're not under your control. We can dance. We can dance.
So I think it is quite amazing that so many of us were inside expressing ourselves through joy. And the police were there, armed to the teeth, but they didn't do a thing. And that is beautiful. And that's showing a lesson in democracy, not only to the park police, but to the rest of this country and around the world.
Police were very unhappy that Russia Today and other mainstream news outlets were able to enter the Jefferson Memorial for this protest and went out of their way to keep anyone else from approaching while they, quote, secured the area and closed the memorial to everyone.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Swanson, activist and author, who assesses the Obama administration's plans for withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan this July and talks about a major anti-war protest scheduled for October 6th. Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, who discusses fossil fuels' impact on the planet's ecosystem and the conditions necessary to change course. And Michael Albert, co-founder of Z Magazine, who looks at the context of the current wave of sustained protests in Spain, challenging the nation's economic and political status quo. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Nearly a year after President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank Act to reform the way big banks and Wall Street do business, the final rules have not been hashed out. ProPublica reports the regulatory process has been slowed down by high-powered banking lobbyists. Of particular concern to reformers is Julie Williams, chief counsel of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or OCC, who is pushing for new exemptions in the proposed regulations, giving banks more opportunity to engage in proprietary trading. Such activity by banks was banned under the so-called Volcker Rule, named after former Federal Reserve Chief Paul Volcker. The Dodd-Frank Act established 387 rules covering 20 different agencies in the 2,000-page bill. In recent weeks, New York lawmakers, including Senators Charles Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, signed a letter to regulators complaining that emerging rules on financial derivatives would put U.S. banks at a disadvantage. Moreover, the U.S. Treasury Department has proposed exempting some foreign exchange derivatives from the requirement that they must be traded on open exchanges. Despite mounting criticism, Congressman Barney Frank, co-author of the law, praised recent progress. This includes development of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, plus greater shareholder say over CEO pay and new protections for whistleblowers. On May 23rd, Haitian police started tearing apart three refugee settlements in Delmas, a self-governing area in the capital city of Port-au-Prince. On the order of Mayor Wilson Jeudy, security forces destroyed over 100 tents used by families and hauled away their belongings. The families were made homeless by the devastating 2010 earthquake that leveled Port-au-Prince. According to the website Other Worlds Are Possible, three residents of the camps were arrested and several community activists were beaten by police. Immediately after the raid, civil society activists, including attorney Patrice Florvilus of Defenders of the Oppressed and the group Force for Reflection and Action on Housing, or FRACA, condemned the eviction. Mayor Jeudy defended his action, saying he was trying to preserve public spaces. The mayor refused to offer compensation to those evicted, saying, "We are all victims of the earthquake." 2 days before the camp demolition in Delmas, several hundred displaced Haitians protested against evictions that took place at Camp Carrad. The action was part of the International Forum on the Housing Crisis, sponsored by dozens of Haitian grassroots organizations. The forum called for authorities to stop violence against displaced persons in camp raids. A deadly outbreak of a new strain of E. coli has killed 25 people in Germany and sickened over 2,000 people, with hundreds in intensive care. German public health officials are still searching for the source of the deadly E. coli, and the World Health Organization is warning that time is running out to find the source. German authorities initially blamed Spanish cucumbers and then lettuce, tomatoes, and cucumbers in Germany for the outbreak. Health officials also targeted a single farm that grew bean sprouts for the outbreak, but tests turned up negative. The new strain of E. coli can lead to kidney failure, seizure, or stroke, as the bacteria releases a toxin that destroys human blood cells. Most of the victims were adult women. The outbreak has led to new tensions between trading partners in the European Union. Spain has threatened to sue Germany for $300 million lost in produce crop profits. Russia also imposed a ban on vegetable imports from the EU because of the outbreak. A similar outbreak could occur in the U.S., since farmers and food processors are not required to test for the new E. coli strain. In recent years, American food safety experts have focused on new E. coli strains in meat, but the FDA has not required testing for E. coli in fresh produce. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
When President Obama announced his decision to deploy 30,000 additional U.S. troops to Afghanistan in December 2009, he also pledged to begin a withdrawal of those troops beginning July 2011. The promise to wind down the war in Afghanistan was politically necessary, with a growing number of U.S. citizens no longer supportive of a war that will be entering its 11th year this October. But with July's withdrawal date fast approaching, the White House is hinting that the withdrawal of U.S. troops may be larger than the anticipated token drawdown of 3,000 to 5,000 troops. How many American soldiers will come home in July is now being debated by the administration and the Pentagon. The competing arguments in play appear to be the symbolic impact of the U.S. raid, which killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, and the military's concern that a substantial withdrawal of American forces now would risk gains made against the Taliban insurgency by last year's troop surge. However, the mood among members of Congress has shifted, with many anti-war Democrats and anti-Obama Republicans casting nearly enough votes in May to pass a bill to accelerate the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Since the 2008 presidential election, the U.S. peace movement has waned, with fewer anti-war protests and less participation in vigils, teach-ins, and lobbying of Congress. But now, a new protest is being organized for October 6th with the goal of placing new attention on the war in Afghanistan and demanding an end to the conflict as the U.S. military combat role there enters its second decade. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Swanson, co-founder of the group AfterDowningStreet.org, who discusses the Obama administration's plans for withdrawing U.S. forces from Afghanistan and the organizing now underway for a sustained and militant protest in Washington, D.C. on October 6th.
This is a president and a vice president and others in the administration who have been promising, swearing a significant, substantial withdrawal in July for a year and a half. And now you, in recent weeks, you've heard, well, it might be 5,000 troops. Right. This is, and then you find out, well, it's actually troops and contractors adding up to 5,000. And that's not out of a total of 100,000. That's out of a total of 200,000 or so troops and contractors in Afghanistan. So that's about 2.5%. Now you start seeing numbers ranging from 3,000 to 5,000. So you've got a range of 1.5% to 2.5%. of the Americans in Afghanistan being pulled out in July. And the New York Times, without suggesting any numbers, says, and it might be even more than that. Well, you know, it could be either extreme in this big range that they're now debating between 3,000 and 5,000 men and women. In either case, it doesn't begin to amount to what's been promised here, right? I mean, this is a president who did keep his promises on Afghanistan from the campaign. He said, I'm going to escalate it, that's the good war, and he did so. But later, as president, he promised a serious withdrawal this July, and now appears to be backing off from that. And, you know, we didn't elect him on that promise, and we can't vote him out on this backing off. We have to have some sort of way to pressure these people to listen to us in between elections.
Obama, when he talked about a withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan this summer, was vague, certainly, on the numbers, although substantial troops doesn't sound like just a few thousand, maybe support soldiers and contractors. What do you think would meet that pledge of Obama to withdraw a significant number of troops.
This is a president who has escalated this war by 60 or 70,000 troops, plus a similar number of contractors. And those have both been described as surges. You know, one was in 2009, happened with almost no public debate or discussion. The next one happened at the end of 2009 and in 2010, and there was a lot of discussion about it, and it was a big surge, and that's where the promise was made that the withdrawal would start in July, with a big withdrawal in July and proceeding from there. So as long as those are going to be considered surges, I think they have to end. I think you have to pull out those 70,000 troops plus contractors and get back to the level you were at before, and then continue, because the Afghan people don't want them there. The American people overwhelmingly don't want them there. The rule of law is against it. Our budget is against it. The natural environment, our civil liberties, our own representative government are against it. There's not an argument for staying.
David, you wrote a very interesting article recently titled "Our Tahrir Square, DC's Freedom Plaza on October 6th. You're proposing organizing a sustained protest movement a la Egypt, Tunisia, but what's going on in Spain, that would not just be a nice Saturday afternoon out, as you said in the article, patting ourselves on the back for being good protesters, but actually a sustained movement that will have more impact here in the United States. Tell us about that proposal.
As I've talked to people around the country and I ask them, do you want to come to Washington for another rally or speeches or march or, you know, make home movies and go back home? There's not much interest. But do you want to come for the one big event that you'll be able to tell your grandkids you were part of, where we actually get in the way and shut things down and hurt the war machine and the Wall Street funding, misrepresenting government until it begins to listen to the people? Then they say, yeah, I'm there. I'll quit my job. I'll risk relationships with my loved ones. I'll do what it takes. I'll be there. And so it's not just me proposing this. A number of people and groups had this idea around the same time some weeks back and have now put together an initial coalition that's announced an invitation for more groups and organizations and individuals to join in. And you can actually go to October2011.org and sign up that you'll be there. You can even sign up, I'll be there only if at least 50,000 other people will be there with me. And then we'll fill you in on how many people are going to be there. I expect it will be well over that number. And the intention is very much to nonviolently occupy Freedom Plaza, which has a nice resonance with Tahrir Square, and to get in the way and to shut things down until our government begins to listen to us.
That was David Swanson, co-founder of the group AfterDowningStreet.org and author of the book War is a Lie. Learn more about plans for the October 6th protest in Washington, D.C. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The nuclear plant disaster at Fukushima, Japan, has generated months of headlines around the world this year, but it was just last year that the massive oil spill caused by the explosion on the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig in the Gulf of Mexico was similarly in the news for months. Coal extraction is also costly to humans and the environment. Whether in deep mines where many workers globally have died in accidents over the past year, or from black lung disease, which kills many more. Mountaintop removal coal mining in America's Appalachian Mountains has devastated communities and generated deadly air and water pollution. Even production of natural gas, which has been touted as the cleanest of fossil fuels, has led to deadly explosions and likely contamination of drinking water as a result of extraction methods such as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Michael Clare is professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. He's an authority on the interface between energy production and security, examining both military and environmental issues. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Professor Clare, who discusses fossil fuels' impact on human health and the planet's ecosystem, assessing the conditions necessary to change course.
Demand for oil is expected to increase about 25 or 30% over the next quarter of a century, and mostly that's going to come from the developing world, from China and India in particular. And a lot of that is a product of growing consumerism in those countries, especially people buying automobiles for the first time. When you have hundreds of millions of people suddenly entering the middle class and running out and buying cars, you're going to create an enormous demand for oil if those cars are powered by oil, which is the case most of the time. So if we go down that trajectory, there's going to be a huge increase in demand for oil.
Just talk a little about where the oil would come from.
Right. The fact of the matter is that most of what people call easy oil is now gone. Easy oil is the stuff that you get on land or in shallow coastal waters where you dig a drill into the earth and it comes spurting out, you know, gushers. That kind of stuff is all gone now. What's left is tough oil of one sort or another. It could be deep offshore and you need multi-million dollar, billion dollar rigs like the Deepwater Horizon to go out in very deep water to get it. Or it's geologically complex, like Canadian tar sands. It's not oil at all. It's something else entirely, bitumen, that has to be converted into oil in a very costly, environmentally risky process. Or it's in the Arctic, and you have very difficult climate conditions to overcome. That's pretty much what's left of the world's oil at this point.
You know, a lot of politicians and industries in America are now saying, well, that's okay, because we'll go to this new thing, hydrofracking for natural gas as a replacement. And it is cleaner than oil, but there are a lot of problems with it, too. Can you talk about that in terms of a replacement fuel?
There's certainly a lot of attraction to relying more on natural gas because it releases less carbon dioxide than oil or coal when it's burned, but it still releases carbon dioxide. It doesn't escape entirely the problem of greenhouse gas emissions. It's just better than the other two. And we have a lot of it in the United States, so you avoid the trap of being dependent on foreign suppliers in places like the Middle East that are very problematic. But we shouldn't assume that getting it out of the earth is all that easy, because most of the natural gas in the U.S. is in deep underground shale formations or tight sands, so-called, and it's very difficult to get at it. You have to smash the rock. You have to fracture it or frack it, and that requires explosives and chemical poisons and a lot of water. And when you engage in those procedures, you wind up with a lot of toxic wastes.
Coal is the dirtiest fossil fuel of all, but there's a huge amount of it in the U.S., especially in the West. And companies are even talking about liquefying it to use in place of oil, which would be a disaster as far as the climate is concerned.
There's a tremendous amount of coal in the United States, but coal is something that comes in many different gradations. There's the hard, dark black coal, which burns very well, and there's brown coal, so-called, you know, less desirable coal that when it burns has a lot of impurities. And we've used up a lot of the really good coal, the anthracite, and what's left is of increasingly low grades of coal, which needs a lot of processing if you're going to use it without creating tremendous amounts of pollution. Or if you burn it, you are going to have ever-increasing levels of pollution. So the question is, you know, how much reliance do you want to have on coal? How much of the Earth's atmosphere do you want to pollute and destroy?
Michael Clare, I find all of this pretty depressing. Do you have any thoughts about how we could shift this terrible trajectory that we're on?
You know, my sense is, to be perfectly honest, is that Americans aren't suffering enough yet from the consequences of our reliance on the existing energy paradigm. That is, we continue to use oil as if it's going to exist forever and that there are no consequences for using it. And I think we have to see the negative consequences a little bit more before enough people are going to feel the need to make a change. There just isn't yet enough downsides experienced in people's everyday lives. We're beginning to see some of that. And, you know, in the higher prices of oil, that's a wake-up call. And I think that the freaky weather we're having is another wake-up call. But we're going to have to see a lot more of that before people say, enough, we need to do things differently. We haven't reached that point yet.
That was Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. His latest book is titled Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. For links to Professor Clare's recent articles, visit our website at btlonline.org. The economic crisis gripping Europe and government austerity measures have triggered angry demonstrations in major cities across the continent, including Athens, Paris, and London. More recently, young activists in Spain poured into the streets and, taking inspiration from the popular revolts in the Middle East and North Africa, have occupied Madrid's Puerta del Sol Square. There, Spaniards from all walks of life have gathered in unexpectedly large numbers to protest an economic and political system they say has given them no hope for the future. Activists in the square, who call themselves indignados, or the outraged, have organized themselves into a small city run by democratic councils. Police attempts to forcibly remove the demonstrators only swelled their numbers. The protest, which began on a small scale prior to local and regional elections on May 22nd, have spread across Spain to Barcelona and 50 other cities and towns, and are now in their fourth week. Many of the activists camped out in Puerta del Sol Square speak out on behalf of immigrants and against world hunger. But the major motivation for participation is the estimated 45% unemployment rate plaguing Spaniards under the age of 30. Even those lucky enough to have a job are frustrated by being stuck in temporary, poorly paid jobs that forces many to live with their parents. Anger at Spain's two major political parties, the center-left Socialists and the right-wing People's Party, has fueled demands for constitutional change to permit a political opening for other new electoral movements. Other demands include increased taxes on the rich, a higher minimum wage, and more control over big banks and financial institutions. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Albert, co-founder of Z Magazine and author, who examines the current wave of sustained protests in Spain, challenging the nation's economic and political status quo.
If you think about it, what's a crisis? A crisis is a disruption in the economy that affects the rich and the powerful. If tens of millions of people a year die of starvation, that's not a crisis. People are unemployed. That's not a crisis. It's only a crisis when it threatens profit. Then the media calls it a crisis. And then the powers that be try to solve the crisis, and they try to do it in a way that betters their own lot. Well, if the public buys that, then what you have is a situation where the public goes along with instructions from the top that says basically, look, you have to shoulder the burden, you have to get less income, you have to lose your job, you have to lose public services, and that's what happens. And the net result is that eventually the economy is righted, and the great mass of people is weaker than they were before. So what's happening in Spain, and in Greece, say, or it may even be larger, what's happening in these countries is that the public has decided, or at least a significant portion of the public has decided, hold on a second, the solution to this problem shouldn't be that the great bulk of us, that working people and young people and poor people, are worse off. It should be that we're better off. It should be that we not only get back to a situation in which the economy is functioning, and we not only get back to a situation in which the causes of these problems are no longer operative, but we should get back to a situation in which some justice has been attained. Maybe not as much as some of us would like, but more than we have now, and that we're better off. And so people take to the streets, and they start to make demands, and what they're demanding is that we go forward in a way that isn't geared to profit the profit makers. It's geared instead to benefit those who have been on the bottom all along. And that's really what's happening. And then what happens, and you see it in Spain, you see it in Greece, You saw it before that in Argentina some years ago. What happens is the public starts to get aroused, and it might be a small event that kicks it off, say in North Africa. A particular event might kick it off. A long-standing bit of organizing might kick it off. In Egypt, that was the case. It could be that some students become aroused, and then the response kicks it off. Whatever happens, people begin to get it in their head that, wait a second, we can actually impact the situation. And that's the crucial leap that has to happen. People have to move from cynicism and despair and the belief that nothing's really possible and therefore I should just try and, you know, come through this surviving, to a belief that we can get together and do something productive here and make a situation that is beneficial for everybody instead of just for the rich.
I just want to gauge your optimism. You've been at this quite a while, reimagining new political and economic structures. Your book, Paracon, Life After Capitalism, Participatory Economics, is something you've talked about, written about, and done a lot of work on. Do you see similar signs of people looking for alternatives, trying to reimagine a future where we could actually put together a blueprint where there'll be some alternatives that are workable or pragmatic?
Yes, even if I didn't, I'd still be optimistic, because history is long. And if we keep working and we keep functioning, you lose, you lose, you lose, you win. And you only have to win real liberty and real participation once. So my answer is I'd still be. But actually, in answer to your question, yes, at the moment I see tremendous potential. I think if Joe Hill, you know, an American organizer, came back tomorrow, he would look around and he would say, oh my gosh, this country is like, you know, an organizer's dream. Everybody understands that the basic institutions are corrupt and rotten and serve only narrow interests. Everybody gets that. Nobody even denies it. All of popular culture is full of novels and movies which show it. And he would say, in that context, with people's anger and with people's pain, it ought to be easy to organize people. Now, he'd be wrong, because that optical of hopelessness and cynicism is a hard one to overcome. But over the past few years, and at an escalating rate, I think it is beginning to get chipped away, and it is beginning to dissipate, and people are beginning to think positively rather than just bemoan their pain. And I don't think it takes long. Once you sort of turn a corner, and once people's mindset starts to shift, the speed with which it's possible for a new attitude to overtake large sectors of the population and lead to activity will be quite striking.
That was Michael Albert, co-founder of Z Magazine and author of Paracon, Life After Capitalism. Read more about the Spanish protests by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
There are those who say you can't fight City Hall. There are those who say protesting is a waste of time. In D.C., however, they've just been proven wrong. when D.C. Council Chairman Kwame Brown proposed to close all homeless shelters to avoid raising taxes on the rich, about 200 protesters swarmed the Wilson Building. When they went to Kwame Brown's office, some warned that if homeless people were turned out of shelters, riots would be next.
There were tent cities. That's what this city's going to turn into if we don't save these benefits and shelters for people to live in. Now, also, after Dr. King's death, there were riots, or at least a riot, terrible riot that affected a large part of the city. That can also happen. So you either go to jail now, or you go to jail next year.
They got that about the riots. As a result, Kwame Brown threw in a towel. The shelters will stay open. He still chose to nickel and dime the middle class with fees instead of taxing the rich. But remember, it wasn't the middle class saying they would riot, and it wasn't the middle class looking at sleeping outdoors every night except during hypothermia season. Protest works. You can fight City Hall. Don't just vote. Organize. Get together with your neighbors and those you know the most. Stand up to Walmart. Stand up to City Hall. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'll do everything I can to protect whales and the other beings in the ocean. Not for people, but for them.
What would you do to save the animals and the ecosphere? How far would you go? Paul Watson says humans are a violent and dangerous species. The environmentalist and early founder of Greenpeace in Vancouver went to the edge of violence to save seals, dolphins, and especially the whales from human slaughter. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat. I've just seen the premiere of a new film biography, Eco-Pirate, The Story of Paul Watson. We see young Paul on a dying whale, standing pat in front of an advancing icebreaker, ramming a rogue whaling ship, and taking on the Japanese whaling fleet year after year in harsh Antarctic waters. Writer and director Trish Dolman spent years on the ships of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. She includes the harshest critics in her film, making this the definitive biography of one of the Earth's greatest environmentalists. Let's get straight to Paul's update on the new Sea Shepherd actions, his good news for whales, and the lively Q&A with a wildly supportive audience in Vancouver, Canada, where the man started his 40-year voyage for the Earth's defenseless creatures. This is Paul Watson and Trish Dolman, recorded by Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat Radio at the Projecting Change 2011 Film Festival, May 27th.
Well, I know everyone wants to hear Paul talk, but I just want to say a couple things because there's a couple more people I want to thank. Leah Mallon, who's in the audience, worked on the film, helping me develop it early on. And then I really need to thank my producer, Kevin Eastwood, who's not here tonight. He's actually working on another show for Animal Planet called Animal Hoarders, so he's running around the States. But he tirelessly worked on this film for the last 3.5 years, and it really did take a village of people to make it. So one of the things for me that about making the film, it's been a great honor to actually be able to interview some of the giants of the environmental movement. Obviously Paul, but Paul Spong, Rex Weiler, all these people who, you know, created incredible change starting in the 60s and 70s. And one of the greatest moments for me was being on the ship. And it really dawned on me when we were patrolling the Galapagos that the oceans are a vast place. And I think because humans are land mammals, we tend to think that people are following regulations. And it was like a light bulb going on, knowing that they're pretty lawless. And Paul is a unique individual in the world. doing the work he does. So thanks, Paul.
Thanks. Just wanted to update. This year we went back down with three ships, and this was our most effective year ever. The Japanese whaling fleet took only 15% of their quota, and they left a month and a half earlier than expected, and I don't think they're going to come back. But if they do, we'll be back there waiting for them. Meanwhile, the Steve Irwin is in southern France. We replaced the Adigil with a new vessel, which we named Gojira, which means Godzilla. Godzilla, actually, Gojira means in Japanese gorilla whale, so we thought it was quite appropriate. I just couldn't resist the headlines of Godzilla chases whaling fleet out of Antarctica. You know, in Japan, of course, Gojira in Japan has a completely different meaning. But unfortunately, the only thing more frightening than Godzilla is Godzilla's lawyers. And so we were told we couldn't use the name, but that's okay. It fulfilled its function. And then 2 days ago, we just renamed the vessel, so it's now the Brigitte Bardot, and gave us a terrific media coverage in France there 2 days ago. So the Brigitte Bardot is with the Steve Irwin in Toulon, and in a couple of days, we'll be leaving to go to the coast of Libya. And the reason being is that the poachers are going to take advantage of the war zone, and the EU has assured us that any fishing vessel we find in that zone, we can cut their nets and free the fish, that any fishing vessel is illegal. Now, last year we cut the nets and released 800 tuna, and when people are concerned about our safety this year, it's much safer this year than it was last year. First of all, no Libyan Air Force. Second of all, no Libyan Navy. We just have to worry about friendly fire from NATO, but we'll keep them advised as to where we are. And right after that, we will be taking the vessels to the International Whaling Commission meeting this year, which is in July, and it's being held in Jersey, in the Isle of Jersey. And then from there, we'll be going up to the Danish Faroe Islands to interfere with the killing of pilot whales there. Also, we've had a crew in Japan for the last 6 months, and they succeeded in cutting the dolphin kill quota by half. 800 dolphins were killed this year, but 800 were killed, but every year it's usually about 1,600 to 1,800. So, you know, but that was a six-month crew on the ground for 6 months. And, in fact, we almost lost some because on March, I think the 12th, our crew were in, of all the days to go to the northern part of the island to check out dolphin killing. They were in Iwate Prefecture when our crew leader noticed the water being sucked out of the harbor. And they got up on top of a hill just in time, and 9 minutes later, the tsunami wiped out that entire town. And we lost them for about 40 hours, but in true Sea Shepherd fashion, the next morning they commandeered a Japanese fire truck and drove them way down the hill. Unfortunately, Japan has it treats us really as like, it's almost an honor, really. They treat us like we're a foreign nation that they're at war with. And they've been putting a lot of pressure on it. I'm now officially, by the way, on the Interpol blue list. What that means is I'm not wanted for anything, but people are instructed to give me a hard time when I cross borders. And I first learned about this when I drove from here down to Washington. And I happen to hold both passports, so they can't keep me out of the U.S., can't keep me out of Canada, much of the frustration in both countries. But as I drove down across the border, I just calmly handed my passport over, not suspecting anything, and suddenly the officer said, "Put your hand on the wheel now, sir." And all of a sudden, sirens started going off, and my hands are on the wheel, and I noticed that there was guys behind concrete blocks with guns aimed at me. And they said, "Throw out your keys." "Well, I can't throw out my keys with my hands on the wheel." So then he got me out of the car, handcuffed me, threw me in, and 10 minutes later, I was on my way, because apparently there's no warrant for my arrest. But what I found out is that I'm on the document as armed and dangerous eco-terrorist. Now, what we've managed to do, I've managed to make this work for me now, so that just yesterday coming into Chicago, we call ahead now and everything gets cleared, but I'm met at the airport by the Homeland Security guys. who I know now and very friendly, and they escort me right to the front of the line and out the door. I'm out there before everybody else, so I'm getting the VIP. I call it the blue list VIP treatment, and so very thankful to Japan for that. But anyway. Hopefully we won't have to go back. And we're actually making other progress. Right after that, I was invited by the president to Palau to come visit him in March. And we were requested if we could help them. And so we said, yeah, we'll provide our vessel, the Bob Barker. We'll take it and send it to Palau to police their waters. Because all of these island nations are getting just completely plundered by illegal fishing operations. There's more illegal fishing in the world now than there is legal fishing. And so we agreed, and we signed a contract with the Palau government to officially police their waters. Well, Japan found out about that. They sent a delegation. Despite the earthquake and the tsunami, they still sent a delegation down there to demand that Palau not work with us. And, of course, the president didn't give in on this, but then they said, well, we'll give you a patrol boat and the money to run it. And so the president called me. I said, well, take the patrol boat and take the money. That's great. You know, so which he did, and now we're going to Nauru and the Cook Islands and the Marshall Islands. I think we can get Japan to provide patrol boats to everybody this way. So thank you. We'd be very pleased to answer any questions anybody has.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat. You've just heard Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society and director Trish Dolman following the premiere of the new film Eco Pirate, The Story of Paul Watson. Let's go straight to the question and answer period in Vancouver.
All right, questions right here.
Thank you for your remarkable work. I wonder how we can use some of the same techniques you've used for marine mammals to protect all species in global warming. What kinds of exciting, important, revolutionary techniques do you think we can use there?
I think really what you need to concentrate on is that the solution to all these problems lies in the passion, the courage, and the imagination of individuals, and not to depend on governments. They never solve problems, they cause problems, but to depend upon that kind of passion. And just imagination is really the way to find out about it, or to find these solutions. When people say that, it's so overwhelming, I mean, what can we do? I mean, it's impossible. Well, I think that the answer is always the impossible one. You just have to be able to visualize that answer. For instance, in 1972, the very idea that Nelson Mandela would be president of South Africa was unthinkable, unimaginable, and impossible, yet it happened. So I think we can solve these problems, and that's why I take an optimistic outlook on this.
Next question.
In the film, you said there was a question of your retiring. What's your comment on that?
Well, first of all, I've never, ever believed in retirement. My grandfather, my mother's father, died at 96, and he was murdered. So he was working till the day he died. He still managed to wound the guy enough that he was arrested. So I don't believe in retirement, and I don't intend to retire. In fact, I'm quite enjoying what I'm doing. And I don't know, people seem to think I'm getting old or something. That question keeps coming up all the time. I'm not that old. I'm the youngest founding member of Greenpeace.
How old are you?
Well, in December I turned 60.
Question. He won't retire. Having been on the ships, I don't think Paul will ever retire.
In the year 2000, when the tsunami hit Southeast Asia, the Canadian government financed the rebuilding of fish boats in Sri Lanka. And the Canadian press, when the tsunami hit Japan a couple of months ago, it was considered to be unethical to raise the issue that this was some kind of karma that was due to them. Maybe you'd like to comment on that.
Oh, no, the earthquake and the tsunami in Japan were not karma. It's a question of geography and geology. And so I actually get very upset when people say the Japanese deserve this. It's not the Japanese people. It's just like, you know, you and I are not responsible for the seal hunt as Canadians, just as the average Japanese is not responsible for the killing of whales and the killing of dolphins. It's a certain segment of these societies. And ultimately, it falls on the government. In this country, the single most corrupt and probably ridiculous bureaucracy in this country is the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. They are totally incompetent. They destroyed the cod fishery on the East Coast, and they will wipe out the salmon on the West Coast. These people are environmental criminals. And, you know, they're always saying, oh, well, we have the best scientists in the world. You know, they have the best biostitutes in the world. These are people who come up with the scientific justifications for their political policies. And that, you know, and they're wrong. They've been wrong consistently. Well, you know, I hate to say that. As long as this country keeps voting for assholes like Stephen Harper, then it's all going to go down the tube. That man is an ecological criminal. You know today that we dropped $200,000 bombs on Libya? What the hell is Canada thinking?
Any more questions? Follow that one. Oh, here we go. It's getting fired up.
Hi, Paul. I would like to just preface this real fast. I ran for the Pirate Party Canada in Vancouver Centre during this last election. I was asked by a reporter, is there somebody who you'd want to be? And I said, well, I don't want to be anybody. I want to be Travis McCrae, but I would like to have Paul Watson say one day, you know that Travis McCrae is a pretty good guy. And I'm also, Peter just told me that I'm probably going to be the communications officer on one of your ships. I have no problem dying in your name, or, you know, in the name of, not in your name, but in the name of the environment under your command.
You ran for Vancouver Center?
Yes, I did.
You and I have that in common. I ran for MP for Vancouver Center. We both lost.
So, now, my real question is, I've noticed that, especially with a lot of the young people, we don't have balls anymore. I mean, I think that's it. I mean, people are not standing up and going out and standing up for what they believe in as much as they used to. At least, you know, I look at the videos of the 60s and everybody going out. Okay, what is your opinion on that?
I disagree completely. I mean, if it wasn't for the passion and the courage of the individuals that crew my ships, we wouldn't be able to do anything. And I've got 2,000 crew applications right now, more than we've ever had. And the hardest part of my job on that is saying no to so many people. You know, we don't want to, but we just don't have the room. This last campaign to Antarctica was 88 crew from 23 different nations on 3 different ships. And these are the people who make our organization effective. And I'm seeing more and more young people getting involved, more so, I would say, than in the 70s or the 80s. So I completely take a different view on that, really. I think that there's a much more involvement, and I'm very optimistic about that.
Can I just add to that, too? I think it's the world's changed. I mean, people used to take to the streets perhaps more visibly than people do now, and that was more effective then, and the world has changed and become much more sophisticated. So now I think there's far more room for people and young people to use the internet, to use YouTube, to use all these things that didn't exist 30 years ago to spread a social message. And I think there's lots of people doing that are inspired by people like Paul and Sea Shepherd. So it's just different. The playing field is different.
One of the things that, you know, we're constantly criticized because of the way we do things and everything. But the reality of it is that in the entire history of our organization, we've never injured anybody. We've never had anybody seriously injured. We've never actually committed a felony or been convicted of a felony crime. You know, 2 years ago, I was invited to give a lecture to the FBI Academy in Quantico, of all things, and they actually paid me to come lecture the FBI. And one of the FBI agents said, well, you know, Sea Shepherd's walking a pretty damn fine line when it comes to the law. And I said, well, who cares how fine it is as long as you don't cross the line. So they couldn't disagree with that logic. But one of them said, well, you know, people come into Sea Shepherd and they learn how to be eco-terrorists. You know, there's some of your ex-crew members have gone on to be eco-terrorists, whatever that is. I don't think they're working for British Petroleum, but anyway, But I said, so how am I responsible for what people do when they leave Sea Shepherd? You train them, you're responsible. I said, okay, I have 3 names for you. Lee Harvey Oswald, Timothy McVeigh, and Osama bin Laden. You trained them. You're responsible. Actually, 3 of them joined. I don't know if that's to keep tabs on us or not.
Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Love you.
Thanks.
Do you still live in Gig Harbor?
Never did live in Gig
Harbor. Oh, where
Friday Harbor.
Friday Harbor. Are you still there?
About 2 weeks a year.
Oh, well, that's true. Well, you're our national treasure.
despite DFO. Where do we stand on the seal hunt, or the sea shepherd stance on the seal hunt? It's a real black mark on our country.
The Canadian seal hunt, for all intents and purposes, is over. There's no market. Europe has banned the seal pelts. Are banned. China just banned seal pelts. But Canada just can't let it go. So this idiot who runs DFO, with Gail Shea, whatever
Gail it is. Shea, yeah.
Shea, yeah. She just set the quota at 460,000, the highest quota in the history of the seal hunt. Absolutely ridiculous. What was that all about? Thumbing their nose at Europe. It's a bunch of kindergarten guys in there just fighting with each other. It's ridiculous. But how many seals are going to be killed this year? Maybe 50, 60,000, which is a lot, but still a lot less the quota because there's no money in it. We have effectively destroyed the market, and that is the only language anybody understands, is profit and loss. Now, the one thing, the government wants us to go back in there, but we're not doing it because they know that if we go back in there, it will just rile up everybody and all this national patriotism and everything, and let's go kill a seal in order to piss off Sea Shepherd. We're not going to do it. The seal hunt is dying, and we're going to let it die. Now we're going to turn our attentions to trying to stop the slaughter of seals in Namibia. So that's what we'll be doing for now. But I think that within a couple of years, it'll die out a natural death. After, you know, and they will no longer have seal stew in the parliament buildings, and Harper won't be walking around with a silly little sealskin briefcase and everything. You know, and you don't have the governor general eating raw seal hearts on television like, you know, some sort of barbarian princess. I mean, the thing is getting... You know, Canada's just been really crazy on this, and but I think we'll grow up.
I just want to add one thing to that. I cut about an hour out of the film that was all about the seal hunt, because at one time it was much, much longer. But two things. Elizabeth May said that she felt that the seal hunt was the biggest distraction away from the decimation of the cod fishery, and that's why the Canadian government pursues it, is to keep both fisher people and activists focused on the seal hunt and not thinking about or focusing their attention on the decimation of one of the greatest fish species on the planet, which I thought was very astute. And then I was interviewing a guy who's in charge of PR for the DFO about the seal hunt. And when I asked him, I said, well, don't you see that the role of activists, because they're, you know, vociferously against people like Paul or anyone who opposes a seal hunt, and in fact kind of hate them. And I said, well, don't you see that the social function of an activist is to create change, to create social change, and that activists have actually caused you to change your approach to the seal hunt and try to make it more humane. Otherwise, you never would have cared, because now they run around saying, well, it's humane, it's humane. And the guy turned to me, he goes, you know, I never actually thought of that way. And that, to me, was one of the reasons why I wanted to make this film, is I think people have forgotten the importance of and the social function of activists like Paul Watson. So
one conversation that we had out on the ice with the Coast Guard actually was very funny. I said to the Coast Guard, what are you doing out here? And he says, well, we're protecting the fishermen from people like you, sir. I said, well, who's protecting the seals? And the guy came back and he said, I understand that's your job, sir.
On that note, Paul, thank you very much. Trish, thank you very much, both of you guys.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah, absolutely, one more thing.
I'd just like to say that I'd like to just recognize the one person who means more to me than anybody else and who has stood by me, and that's my daughter, Lily Alani. Thank you.
And if I can just say a few words on behalf of the festival, thank you guys so much for being here. And I just really want to ask you guys for your support, because organizations like Projecting Change provide the platform for Trish to bring her movies here to share with all of you guys. Sea Shepherd is there for you guys to support so they can save the animals. So please get involved. Get on the Sea Shepherd website, the Projecting Change. Come out and see more films, support more filmmakers, so that we can support more eco-terrorists. All right? So take care, guys.
That was Paul Watson, founder and captain of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, with Trish Dolman, writer and director of the new film, Eco Pirate, The Story of Paul Watson. This full-length movie will be released in July. Find links in my blog at ecoshock.info or at screensiren.ca. This was, hands down, the best green documentary I've seen this year. The Arctic footage and shipboard life alone was stunning. Writer Dolman did not create a fan film. She went to Watson's critics, and there are many, from the Japanese ambassador through Canadian officials, even to wives and a daughter left behind on shore. The story of early Greenpeace is woven in, with a careful look at nonviolence versus direct action. There is love and danger when ships collide in the open seas, and you are there as part of the crew. In the end, despite criticism and doubts, admiration for Paul Watson cannot be denied. Certainly the living marine mammals he saved would vote for his life of activism, which incidentally never cost a human life. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock and EarthBeat. I recorded this event at the Projecting Change 2011 Film Festival in Vancouver, Canada, on May 27th. Find out more at ecoshock.info. There is no copyright on this work. Spread it around. Be sure and check out the movie Eco Pirate when it comes out. And find out more about Paul Watson at seashepherd.org.